time was, if you were doing your job as a journalist and, as the saying goes, afflicting the comfortable, then the comfortable would push back and sue you for libel. True, media outlets also simply made mistakes or printed false claims, but dealing with the legal hassle of libel suits was seen as an inevitable part of journalism. So imagine New York Observer reporter John Coblin's surprise when he followed a lead recently and found that in the last few years, libel suits have all but disappeared against the media. Coblin called Time Inc. to ask how many libel suits it currently had. He reached Robin Bierstadt, a 27-year veteran of Time Inc.'s legal team who'd fought back against libel suits by groups like the Church of Scientology. He reached her just in time. She was retiring later that week, and the reason, she explained, was simple.
No more lawsuits. They have not had a pending libel suit over the course of the last year. I then called up the New York Times Company, and the New York Times Company said they have not had an active domestic libel suit on their hands for a year, since last July. And that includes the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and lots of regional newspapers.
Now, is it possible that these kinds of suits may have migrated to small local papers where the impact of a defamatory article might be greater?
It's very possible. I mean, one of the theories that media lawyers have right now, if they're not happening to the big media companies, it could be your smaller newspapers. But there is no concrete evidence on this. Most of the lawyers who I spoke to have represented large media companies. And the thing that they said, it might be happening down there, but we don't know. But we know we're not seeing it up here.
So let's talk about some of their favorite theories. After years of suing companies like Time Inc. and the New York Times, plaintiffs have realized that these cases are losers?
That is a popular theory. The fact that in the U.S., if you sue, it's a libel claim. Generally, it's going to go in favor of the media company. And these are very long and onerous lawsuits. It's expensive. It doesn't work.
Theory number two is just the ubiquity of the web, which seems to balance out the power of any single media company. For instance, when the musician M.I.A. contested a recent profile of her in the New York Times Magazine, she didn't sue. She tweeted her objection. She posted raw audio from the interview along with the reporter's cell phone number. The internet seems to allow potential plaintiffs to fight it out instead in the court of public opinion.
This is the theory that I buy the most. The fact that there is so much out there on the web, the impact of a Time story isn't the way that it was even 10 years ago. And I think potential plaintiffs who would want to sue have to say, this isn't going to harm me in the way that it might have a few years ago. And the point that you brought up, they can put their own responses up. They could go to the Huffington Post and write a blog post. They could post something to their own blog. And if you're upset and you call up that company, there's a good chance that if you're going to get a correction, instead of it sitting in the magazine a week later or 2 weeks later or the newspaper a few days later, you can get it up on the web immediately. So when people Google your name and look at that story later on, they won't see that incriminating fact that you were so upset about.
And newspapers and magazines seem more responsive because they have this mechanism. They do it faster. They don't fight the corrections perhaps as hard.
If you have somebody who's angry and is putting their own response out there and putting their own spin on the story, there is no stonewalling anymore because they're going to have their voice heard. And suddenly, the focus of the story is not your story anymore. It's their response. George Freeman, who's a counsel at the New York Times Company, said, if somebody's upset and we were wrong, we will put up the correction immediately.
I think the scariest theory is the one that involves the suggestion that financially strapped news organizations, first of all, they're putting less money into the kind of investigative reporting that might engender these kinds of suits. And second, they've become so legally risk averse that they avoid investigating the most litigious organizations, like, say, the Church of Scientology or Disney.
Every media lawyer is a little squeamish to talk about this theory because they still represent big companies, and I don't want to admit that they don't perform the type of journalism that would have produced libel suits in the past. But nevertheless, we have to consider this. 15 years ago, when media companies were doing very, very, very well, you get an angry phone call, you're happy to pursue that lawsuit. Doesn't matter. We've got money. But now, in a time where everybody is strapped for cash, all of a sudden, if they make that angry phone call pre-publication, you start to seriously consider editing some stuff out, because who wants to go down that road? Floyd Abrams made a point of this in the interview that I had with him. The very famous First Amendment lawyer said, this is something that media companies carefully consider now, much more so now than ever before.
Now, you've noted that there are fewer libel cases in the U.S., but even more libel cases in Europe, especially in places like the U.K., where the libel laws favor the plaintiffs far more than they do here. Have libel suits, do you think, just migrated to places where they're easier to win?
It is the one loophole. But every media lawyer I spoke to, none of them had a sense that this is a loophole that is exercised much.
When you step back from this trend, are you left with just another sad story of the slow demise of major news organizations? I mean, Time may not be getting sued anymore, but are people there lamenting that maybe, in large part, it's because Time has lost its mojo?
The media's influence is now not just held by a few big newspapers or magazines, and it's certainly an example of that diminishment of power. Whether or not it represents our slow demise of the media overall, I don't think this story at all suggests that.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Kovlin writes about print media for the New York Observer. His piece, The End of Libel, ran at the beginning of June.